Hi, and welcome to Tashma, the podcast where you get to listen in on Hadar's Beit Midrash. I'm Rabbi Avi Killip. We are continuing with our series of calls from our Beit Midrash in New York to our Beit Midrash in Jerusalem, and today also a little bit to Beersheba. I'm glad to be speaking again with Rabbi Avital Hochstein, president for Hadar in Israel, and also today to get to introduce to all of you Dr. Tzivia Frank-Vigoda, who is the newest member of Hadar's staff, coordinating our work in the South. So first, Avital, maybe you'll say hello, and then Tzivia would love to hear from you a little bit about who you are and where you live and what the work you're doing with Hadar is.
Hello. Nice to be with you all, even though the circumstances are not getting lighter.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tzivia, and I just started a few weeks ago working with Hadar. I have been living in Be'er Sheva for the last 20 years, and I'm part of a partnership community in the South, Keilat Be'erot. And basically, I am trying to expand Machon Hadar's work and limud in Israel to Be'er Sheva and to the area of the South of Israel. We've had a very first limud together last week with Rav Avital, and we're looking forward to the next meetings this week and the next few ones. It hasn't been an easy time in Be'er Sheva, of course, in Israel in general, but we really feel that we're living in the midst of the storm, really. I have children, some older ones and some younger ones, and the younger have had a difficult wake-up siren this morning that threw them back to the difficulty of the last few weeks. We've had a few days that were quieter, and we could feel that they were in angst again from the last few days that have been really less quiet. I am a scholar of literature, working on mostly French, Jewish, North African materials. And so when I'm not working with Hadar, either teaching or planning a series of lectures, I am teaching literature and French Jewish thought at Bar-Ilan University.
Tzivia, thank you for sharing. Thank you for being here both at this recording and being here also in the broader sense of being a part of Hadar's work now. We're so glad to have you in both places.
Maybe I can share a drop of a reflection visiting Be'er Sheva a week ago. I went to Be'er Sheva. It seems almost like it was a different world because we were in the ceasefire. So I have to admit, I was a little nervous about rockets, but much, much, much more relaxed than I would have been because in the ceasefire, we didn't have rockets. So I drove down with one of my colleagues, both to see alumni at bases and to meet alumni who live in the South and to meet some of the communities that Tzivia told us about and is working with. I've been walking around with a question these last few days. We went back to war, and with war, there are also casualties. And I felt like the casualties in my community were very many. And I asked myself, is it disproportional? Are more people in the communities I belong to going to combat, or are simply the numbers so high that everyone is being affected? And it's an important question for many reasons, because choosing to understanding your responsibility as one of going to combat is a moral question, is a question of how we understand our duty. And I've been pondering the communities I belong to. And Orit Rappel-Kreuzer, who's director of Hadar in Israel, suggested a theory, which I think connects to the visit in Be'er Sheva. And she basically said, those of us who live in community are affected when things happen to a very broad number of people. It may not affect my day-to-day directly. I may not have a person who's missing in my tomorrow. But the ripple effects when you live in community, which means that people are connected and entwined, goes much further. And it's a price you pay for living in community. And of course, it's also a gain. There's support, there's systems. But I think it was an interesting analysis of how different people are experiencing this time. And the more you live in community and the more communities you are connected to, the more you're being affected. And part, I think, of what was powerful in the visit in Be'er Sheva is that I met many communities. Now, it was one visit. I don't presume to know them yet and so on. But there was a room that was diverse with people's communal connections. And there's, with all the pain, something also very powerful and supportive in that. You know, we learned about war. We sat and we talked about war. But there was power with different people's experiences and perspectives and understandings. So thank you for bringing those communities into the room.
I want to share something I've been experiencing ever since the beginning of the war. And maybe it connects in a sense to what you're saying, but the experience of having people, things, words, places, texts change their meaning suddenly. It can be thinking about the name of my own daughter, Be'eri. She's 10, so her name has absolutely no relationship with Kibbutz Be'eri, except for the fact that we know this place, we love this place, but more than anything, we just love the place we live in, which is Be'er Sheva, and wanted to give a sense of this relationship that we have built with the city over the last years when we gave her her name. But now suddenly, every time we call her Be'eri, we hear something else. And also, I was, I think that this relates to what you were saying about war last week. So I was exchanging messages with a friend of mine who is from Sderot. And ever since the first day, he's been evacuated in Eilat with his family. And at first I was exchanging WhatsApp messages with him, but suddenly for some reason we switched to email. And then I saw the signature that of his email quoting from this piyut that we recite on Rosh Hashanah right before the first blowing of the shofar in North African Sephardi communities. Ha'at b'yom zedatcha shokheach. This is this poem that describes very dramatically the scene of Avraham and Yitzchak. And there is this verse, are you on this day forgetting your own religion? Ha'at b'yom zedatcha shokheach. Oked, the sacrificer. V'ne'ekad, and the sacrifice, or the sacrificed, v'hamizbeach, and the altar. I was so shocked when I read this sentence. I told him, thank you for shocking me or for shaking me with this verse that has taken such an immensely different meaning now, realizing that it is talking about us as being both okdim and ne'ekadim, sacrificer and sacrificed. And then this friend told me, you know, I change my signature once a year, every year on Rosh Hashanah. And so this verse that he chose had not been chosen because of the meaning it took after October 7th. And yet he too could not ignore this additional meaning that these words and so many other words and, as I said before, people and places and things have taken ever since then. And I have this prayer that one day we will, I don't know, recover the original meanings or the previous meanings of so many things that we love. But I also think that there is a value in acknowledging these meanings and addressing them in our lives.
Sylvia, first of all, I just want to say, acknowledge the story that you told earlier about your children waking up to a siren and just acknowledge how hard that is and how sorry I am to hear that. And to really appreciate both of the stories you told, both about your daughter's name and this story from the email, they're both stories about words taking on new meanings, but they're also, as Avital was offering, they're both stories about how you interact with people and the way that the changing meanings of these words actually has changed your interaction with other people. It's not just a verse, but it came to you in an email signature, and this is how he is showing up to everyone that he writes to, you know, and for your daughter, obviously, like, what could be more intimate than your relationship with your own child, and to have this new meaning shift even that intimate of a relationship is just incredibly powerful and a rare experience. We don't often have a change in the way we interpret a word or a text have such an intimate impact on our lives. So it's a very powerful image. So I really appreciate your sharing it.
I started the day texting with a wise friend who doesn't live in Israel. And it made me think about the questions we ask and don't ask. And I think there's something about this war that makes us, on the one hand, ask fundamental questions, and on the other hand, be terrified of asking those fundamental questions. On the one hand, there's an atmosphere around that questions can weaken. And on the other hand, if we're not sharp with the answers, then we're weak. And so we better ask good questions. But it's not easy in times of war to ask anything. Do we want, right? Do we ask everything about our religion right now? Do we ask everything about this country right now? Do we ask everything about sending our kids to the army right now? There is strength and power, and we have to, and also there, it's terrifying of how you come out the other end. And I feel those two pulls very strongly right now. And I think it also makes me ask about human nature. Is questioning a basic human thing? It's definitely basic in our tradition. I don't know if it's a basic human instinct or actually being stubborn, or it connects with being strong, but there's something about rigidity that maybe is more human inclination, especially in times where we're being threatened and attacked.
Right. Not only do you ask questions, but are you open to different answers? Are you open to complicated answers? Are you open to answers that go counter to what you already, how you're already behaving?
I'll suggest a different framing to that. I think war pushes us to think of black and white, good and bad. And reality is just much more complicated. And can we handle that complexity? Can we hold that complexity during war? And how?
Are there questions that are sitting with you today? Big questions?
I'll give the context to the question. My daughter called me in tears last night because a brother of one of the young women who learns with her was killed. She called me with the question I shared earlier, which is this feeling of desperation that it's happening so frequently, all the time, very close to home. It's desperation more than a question, but I think it raised the question of, are we feeling it in our community more than other communities? And what does that mean about the choices we're making? It was hard to console her. And I think the wisest thing I said to her was, I'm here. Because there was really not much more to say.
This week I was talking with a friend, a close friend in Be'er Sheva, and she was expressing her sense of grief and the anxiety that plagues all of us. And she also wrote to me at some point about her child's question, and it has stuck with me. And the question was, can we feel now? And I think that the can meant both, are we allowed, or just do we have the ability in ourselves to feel something other than patriotic anger? And this question is resonating with me over the last few days. I've been thinking about how our feelings reflect who we are as humans and as a society, but they also shape who we are as humans and as a society. And as much as the sense of a collectivity that needs to protect itself prevails now, I also have been looking for inspirations about how to reflect on human beings and humanity and perhaps even compassion in times of crisis. I can't claim that I have any answer. I think that we all feel that we are in long time processes that were initiated on October 7th, but are going to stay with us for years to come and maybe forever. So I don't have answers, but I feel that I'm on a path of trying to figure out what we allow ourselves as individuals and as a society to feel in this specific circumstances, but also in more philosophical ways, and how this could maybe guide us right now and for the future.
That question is especially powerful and scary, Zivia, because you posed it in the story that you shared from the mouth of a child, that it was somebody's child that was asking, am I allowed to feel something other than anger? That's a scary thing to hear a child looking for a way to feel something other than anger, that even the children have internalized that.
I do think it's inspiring that people are able, in even though we are all inside a historical event that, you know, the proportions of which go so much beyond our individual and local selves, it's inspiring for me to realize that we're always, or at least some people, and definitely this child, are able to transcend or to elevate themselves and to question the language, the discourse, the feelings that we are, that are the weft of our life. And I think that, yes, there is something heartbreaking, but also uplifting. We are, as human beings, always able to challenge ourselves or to question the very language that shapes us. Still, we have some freedom to question it.
Yeah, I think there are two things that are inspiring about it. First of all, the awareness of what emotion is driving. And the second is that it's not a default, that there are options around other than this emotion. It's very powerful.
What emotions are you feeling like when you have that conversation with your daughter, or when you have these questions about why is this happening? Why is it happening in particular to our community? What emotions are there?
Somebody shared a poem with me today, which I don't know if it'll answer your question of emotions well enough, but it'll maybe give a feeling of some aspect of what I feel my role is with my kids, in general, with myself. It's written by Smadar Weinstock. Im tifgosh adam shavur, shev ito. If you meet a broken person, sit with them. Al saf ha-shever ha-arur, אל תנסה לתקן. On the brim of a cursed break, don't try to fix. אל תרצה שום דבר ביראה ובאהבת הזולת. Don't want for anything with awe or with love of the other. שב איתו, שלא יהיה שם לבד. Sit with them so they're not there alone. I guess because the emotions are a mixture of fear and desperation, and it's very hard to find hope at certain moments. So there is to be, which is a lot because it's life. I was thinking back to Yonah. Yonah, can you believe it that there's this massive storm and he falls asleep? Like, it's really unbelievable. Hmm. And I'm so tired. And I think it's because I haven't been sleeping so well. And I'm like, how is he not able to sleep? And it accompanies all our slichot. Ben Adam, Malecha Nirdam, right? The captain of the ship says to Yonah, what are you sleeping at this moment? So I guess the half full cup of the way to look at it is to say, we're living. We're here. We're recording a podcast. My daughter calls me when there's a problem. She goes to the funeral, right? There, she's active. There's life.
Meaning she's not sleeping.
Exactly. She's not Yonah. She's not in bed sleeping. So that's a lot when there's a lot of emotions of desperation.
It's beautiful. I know many of us in America are also not sleeping and we'll also appreciate that frame. I think where we are struggling is whether we are being, you know, whether we are the go be with mm-hmm. them, sit with them, is how do we do that from here, and or how do we get to where you are?
Right. Well, having this conversation is definitely a piece of that for us.
I wanted to go back maybe to these feelings that we're struggling with and to say that I've been struggling with the question of how to feel compassion over the last few weeks, knowing that this compassion makes me vulnerable, that this feeling comes with some danger, some actual danger, and maybe also symbolic danger or risk. And I've been trying to find inspiration in traditional sources to think about the idea of human beings or the other in a sense that goes beyond the solidarity of the society we belong to or I belong to, in order to, you know, feel some kind of inspiration for this compassion that I feel, but that also feel is putting my life either pragmatically or metaphorically in danger.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are three models that can provide some framework to work with. The first one is, I would say, the Sefer Dvarim model of protecting the foreign resident along with the orphan and the widow. And this is not really a model for times of crisis. I don't know how much solace it provides for our circumstances, mm-hmm. but it is a model that sets the ideal of a humane, moral society in which the strong sense of collectivity and solidarity that the Torah aims at building does not trump generosity and a humane behavior towards anyone else living in our midst, against a very natural, very human tendency to tighten our social circles and bonds. It's important because I think the Torah is not trying to negate the value of a strong sense of communal belonging, but also encourages us to see beyond this belonging. But again, this is a model for times of peace, for a thriving, flourishing society. And I've been looking for something to bring me inspiration in these times. And I've been thinking about those two opposite models that we have in sources. The one which is human being as being made in the image of God, which is best exemplified in this midrash about Shirat Hayam, about the song of the sea, that when the angels wanted to sing along with the people of Israel, God admonished them, telling, how can you sing when my own creatures are destroyed? It's interesting that against or along with or against the backdrop of the narrative of our creation as a people freed from slavery, this commentary, this midrash, suggests to consider that all human creatures have value because, going back to Bereshit, all humanity is created in God's image. And then there is the opposite model, which says that against this model of humans being created, having value because they were created in God's image, there is the frailty of humanity. And it's the maybe the darkest model of all three. It comes from Noah and the flood rather than from Bereshit. And basically, in after the flood, God promises never to destroy humanity again. And counterintuitively, this promise is not based on the sense of human worth flowing from its divine resemblance, but it is based on the sense of human inner moral failure. Ki yetzer lev adam ra min neurav, right? The inner pulsions of man is bad from the beginning, from man's youth. And I've been thinking how this model resonates deeply in some Holocaust journals or testimonies. I've been thinking in particular of Etty Ilsum's journals. She was a Jewish woman from the Netherlands who perished in the Holocaust. And I was also thinking of a text by the French non-Jewish communist fighter Robert Antelme. He wrote a book called The Human Species, with a very strong emphasis on the word species as basically a very pessimistic view of human nature that allows both him and his fellow inmates in concentration and work camps to be part of the same species with, you know, Nazis torturing them in these camps. And they have very different reactions to this. I think that Etty Hilsum impersonates this kind of maternal love for all humanity and need to heal humanity, whereas Robert Antelme's observation is a much more dismal one. But both of them have this recognition that humanity is frail, is weak, but that weakness is a reason to protect human beings, not to destroy them. These are just, you know, little small thoughts that I've been playing with in my attempt at grounding my sense of vulnerable compassion into sources and traditions that might provide us a metaphorical buoy.
Yeah. Sivia, wow, I'm so blown away. It's so beautiful and there's so much there. I want to ask, of these three models, do you find yourself moving between them? Are you able to hold all of them at the same time? How do they land with you? Do they land differently at different moments?
I couldn't live with only one of them. I need the three of them. They're complementary. They help us navigate times of crisis, like the immense, the hardship of the Holocaust, with other kinds of crises that maybe are resonate with us right now, like Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea, happening at a time that is both a time of vulnerability, but also a time of exhilaration or elation for the Jewish people, just freed from slavery. And I also need to have this ideal of how a good, moral, ethical society should behave and should relate to the foreigner or the stranger. I need these three models to show me different aspects of what it means to consider our own humanity beyond this collectivity that defines belonging. So I think that in the darkest times, it is inspiring for me to go back to Holocaust literature and to find these philosophical pearls that really emanate from the most horrific situations. I feel that for me, it's uplifting to realize that human beings have being in this immense desolation and being able to consider humanity with a compassionate way, even though they were basically about to perish. And then I'm moving to models that have a more optimistic, more positive view of humanity and finding hope, and also not only hope, but also moral injunction in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of incredible, the ability, but also the need to pull both from moments that were worse than this one and moments that are better, to say that, you know, we can't learn only from texts about crisis and war in order to get through this moment. We actually have to also hold on to the ideal society and where we're trying to get to and remember what the goals are. It's really powerful to see you pulling from both of those.
I was so strongly in these texts of Bereshit and Noach when the war started. It's nice to go back to them in a way that insists that we have to hold them all simultaneously. We have no choice. Ultimately, we're trying to build a world that is not in war. And so we have to hold on to the model, which is one where the Dvarim model, as you called it, Tzivia, where we have responsibility towards the other and can implement it, rise up to it. And we have to know that we're created in the image of God, and that puts a lot on us, and that's true about all humanity. And we have to know that we are fallible. I think that's the word, that we are creatures who also fail and are weak, also morally. And we have to navigate all three all the time, all the time. I guess I'll summarize with this thought. I started by saying that I think it's difficult to ask questions. And what Torah does for us is it insists that there is diversity, like asking, are there other options beside anger? So Torah also insists that there are many ways to look at reality. And one way, I think, to tolerate questions is to draw all the time different models and to ask ourselves where we are between them. And so thank you. Thank you for that, Torah Tzivia.
This podcast will be published during Chanukah next week. I'm just curious if you have a reflection on the upcoming holiday.
I have to say that I have never felt so disconnected from Chanukah in my life. I don't know if it's about the language that we use in Chanukah or if it's about the stories that we tell ourselves over Chanukah or just the image of light in the darkness that just right now are too far from our reality for me to really connect with. But with all these things that have currently lost their meaning, and I pray for this meaning to come back, then I hope that next Chanukah we will be able to feel the light out of the darkness and to revive these stories that we tell ourselves for so many years with new meanings.
Amen. Thank you to Effie Unterman for producing this episode and to David Chabinsky for recording and editing this episode.